Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Mosaics. Today, I am in Brookline, Massachusetts, at the beautiful and nearly baronial home of Sam and Hazel Burkholz, who have been kind enough to lend us their living room as our Studio One. And I have with me a very dear friend. I was going to say old friend, but a very dear friend, David Rome, who was the Kasum Kikyep, and he was the secretary to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He was also a member of the board of directors and a member of the cabinet as such and the Privy Council of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And besides his illustrious career as a member of the Vajradhatu community and Shambhala community, he was also a very accomplished practitioner of social enterprise in the world, and also of bringing the traditions of mindfulness into social action. David was also the senior fellow at the Garrison Institute in New York. He was senior's vice president of planning and development at Greyston Foundation in New York also. And before that, he was president of Shokan Press. And he is the author of a forthcoming book called Your Body Knows the Answer, which will be published by Shambhala Publications in the near future. Asking David to talk a little bit about his life is like going to Paris and having 2 days. It's a very difficult organizing challenge. What in the world are you going to do with the little bit of time that we have? So, David, I want to thank you for accepting to be interviewed and ask you to guide us through some of the things in your life that you think are not just important in general, but actually might be helpful to our listeners and to the greater community of practitioners. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
David, how did you meet Trungpa Rinpoche?
I had been hitchhiking in Europe in the summer of 1971 with an old high school friend. This was after I graduated from college. I spent 2 years in the U.S. Peace Corps working as a teacher in East Africa. And it was shortly after I returned from that my friend Alex called me up and said, "Hey, do you want to bum around Europe together for a couple of months?" And he had spent a year in India and was very interested in Gandhi and Eastern spirituality, which I really had almost no experience of at that point. And we started in England, and he really wanted to go to this Tibetan monastery in Scotland called Samya Ling. And I wasn't that keen on it, and I imagined it as kind of like a zoo where there's a fence, and you look over the fence and you see these Tibetan monks doing whatever they do in a Tibetan monastery. But he prevailed, and we drove north to Scotland, and that was where I experienced meditation for the first time. And then at the end of the summer, I went back on my own and stayed there for a week, and I knew there was something there that was right, or that I was touching something that was more real than... And before that, I was somewhat of a lost soul. I mean, the years in the Peace Corps were good, but then coming back to the States, I was at that time, that was one of the several times that I worked in my family's business, the Shokan Books, book publishing. But I was lost and not happy. And so the meditation really clicked. And in the, they had a little bookstore there. And mind you, this was in 1971, where one did not have the flood of books about Buddhism that we have now. They were few and far between. But in the bookstore, there were two books that I bought. One was Mahasi Sayadaw, the Burmese Vipassana teacher, and the other was a little book called Meditation in Action by Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I heard a bit about him while I was there. He was the founder of Samyaling, but he had left under a cloud, and so he wasn't really mentioned that much, but they did have his book. And I'll always remember I had an interview with Akung Rinpoche, who sadly was murdered recently in Tibet. First I talked with him about maybe staying on there at Samyaling, and he said, no, I think you should go back to your own country. And I said, well, I hear that there is another Tibetan teacher there, and or another Tibetan center or something like that. And he said, well, I can't recommend it because I haven't been there myself, but my friend is there. And, you know, at the time I had knew nothing about the history between them. But especially in retrospect, I really appreciate his saying that. So I came back at the end of the summer and visited Tale of the Tiger. I called ahead and was told in a kind of peremptory way, well, you're welcome to visit, but Rinpoche's not here. And, you know, at that point, it wasn't so much about Rinpoche. I hadn't met him yet. So I did. I visited. I arrived there in the afternoon, and within a few hours after my arrival, Trungpa Rinpoche himself arrived on an unscheduled stop to do a, I don't know if it was a Sukhavati, but it was a service in connection with a woman named Melody who had died in Boulder. So I first laid eyes on him in the, what was at that time, the meditation hall, which was the attic of the old house, later the MMGY.
The sun, the mantra, mandalas, vajra, guru yoga.
Guru yoga shrine room, and now it has yet another name. And it's a very small space. And we were sitting there, and he kind of limped in and sat down on a zafu. We didn't have gomdens yet, with a big gong, and led a meditation. He sat with us, and then he made some remarks. After that, we all had dinner together around a low table in what is now the kind of entry lobby at Karma Choling. At the end of dinner, I kind of crept up behind Rinpoche, and asked him about staying there at Tale of the Tiger. And he kind of looked over his shoulder at me, somewhat skeptically, and said, where are you from? And I said, New York, New York City. And he said, I think you should go back to New York City. That's a good place to practice.
They're never going to make it easy for you, was he?
And so I did. And around that time, I actually moved into the very first Dharmadhatu space that that New York had on 18th Street. It was a loft, and it had two small rooms at the front. And so one of those became my bedroom. And he came not long thereafter and taught in New York. Then, you know, things went on from there.
When you were in New York before actually going up to Tale of the Tiger and coming back, you went to school. What did you study? Where did you go and what did you study?
I was at Harvard studying classics, Greek and Latin.
I see, because I remember that Trungpa Rinpoche always kind of leaned on you a little bit about certain kinds of very recherché references on things, so now I know why. Okay, so there you are in New York, and when I actually met you, it was in 1973, I believe, at the first seminary?
Yes.
So you moved pretty quickly. If this was pretty much 1971 and you were in the group of the first seminary, which was in the fall of 1973, your relationship must have moved on very quickly.
Well, yes and no. It was after that seminary in the fall of 73 that I became private secretary to Trungpa Rinpoche. But before that, I was living, initially I went to the land, the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, and then later that fall moved into the old townhouse, which at that point was the only townhouse on Marine Street in Boulder. And I, like everyone else, I would go for sittings and yintuns and community meetings and talks, but I also joined the early theater group. And that's where I think, made more of a connection with Rinpoche, and he took notice of me. At that time, we were doing the sound cycles. I've always loved poetry, and he liked the way that I
recited,
enunciated, proclaimed the sound cycles.
What are the sound cycles?
The sound cycles are six, not exactly poems. They're word. I guess word sequences that combine Sanskrit and English words, and each one has a kind of a theme, as well as a certain sound develops. So the one that comes to mind is about space, and so it goes space, 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 space. That's part of it, and then there are other. Actually, they're wonderful, and they should be better known. I'm not remembering more right now. And then I attended the Mudra Theater Conference in early 1973, which was quite an extraordinary, outrageous event that brought together really leading people in avant-garde theater.
In New York City, right?
No,
in
Boulder.
Boulder.
In Boulder. And that was organized with the help of Jean-Claude Vanatelli, and Ruth Astor did a lot of work on it, and Maurice McClellan. Robert Wilson was there before he became well known, and gave his whole troupe was there and performed, and many others.
Which I suppose at the time was extremely rare, to have this Tibetan master involved with avant-garde theater, exploring the nature of space and movement and sound.
Absolutely.
And mind.
And what a non-aggressive theater might be. And some of the one in particular of the participants had a very aggressive approach, and there was a very sharp dialogue between Rinpoche and this particular director, who then, if I'm not mistaken, left before the program was over. And then in terms of seminary, I think I was kind of a last minute
recruit for color.
Well, more for money, because they knew I had some money, and I was at that time in a relationship with Dimitra Dukas, who became my first wife, in fact. And they knew that not only could I pay for myself, but I could pay for her too. It was something like $350 for a 3-month stay in a resort hotel in Jackson Hole with Trungpa Rinpoche. Maybe it was $450, but it wasn't more than that. So
it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So when you
And you were there.
Yeah, I was there. That's when we met.
Yes.
So if what was it like to be his secretary? I mean, I believe that at that time things were beginning to become somewhat more formal. I remember in going to 1111 Pearl Street and actually having a hallway and waiting and being, you know, he had his office, and there was almost the beginning of an executive approach to the relationship with him. And I believe Berkeley McKeever, and was not McKeever at that time,
Johnson, yeah,
was also a secretary. Tell me about that time.
It was a gradual process. Actually, we what you're remembering was a little bit later. I was first asked by Jonathan Eric, who was his secretary at the time, if I would simply assist in with his schedule. And again, it was because I wasn't working, and I had a car. I had a Chevrolet Impala convertible, which was pretty fancy
for a bunch of hippies.
For a bunch of hippies, yeah. And almost immediately, I was going up to his home in Four Mile Canyon at that time, getting him up in the morning, getting him dressed, getting him his tea and ramen noodle breakfast, driving him down to the office at 1111 Pearl Street. But it was not yet the corner office. It was it was a different, quite a small space that we had at that point. Seeing him through his whole day, which more often than not ended with either with a talk or with, at that time he used to go visit with students in their homes, or he liked to go to Tico's, the Mexican restaurant. And some nights we just went over there, and he sat in the car while I went in and got a double order of Mexican rice, I think, and then drove him back up to Four Mile Canyon and helped him with his dinner and undressing and putting him to bed.
Day in and day out?
At the beginning, yes. For the first... So I started in January, and that routine continued through that first summer of Naropa.
So you were secretary in Kusum.
Yes, secretary Kusum
Kasum. No,
right.
Name at such.
Right. I was yes. I like to say that. When I stopped doing that, they had to replace me with dozens and dozens of kasung and kusung and various other secretaries
and aide-de-camps and
aide-de-camps, and that's right.
It's true. I mean, several institutions were created.
And then I had an accident. Somebody drove into the driver's side door of my Chevrolet and it wouldn't open anymore. And so there was a period in which I would have to get in the car from the passenger side, then Rinpoche would get in, and then, like, if we went to Tico's to pick up a double order of Mexican rice, he would stay there in the front seat, and it was a two-door car. I would have to climb into the back seat and then squeeze out beside him through his door, and so he then got a Mercedes and started having costume drivers, and I attribute the whole development of the Kingdom of Shambhala to my damaged Chevrolet.
Well, who knows? Who knows? It's called the mishap lineage. It's interesting because what's in between there, obviously, was the visit of His Holiness the Karmapa, at which point everything became blown out in terms of all these functions that you talked about actually becoming institutions that outlasted individual people.
Yes, that's right. I mean, first was that famous initial summer of Naropa in the summer of 1974. And then immediately following that, in the fall, the first visit of the Karmapa. And for that, of course, we had to organize drivers and security and service, and that was the either the stimulus or the opportunity for Rinpoche to begin formalizing things in terms of how we dressed and how we behaved and much else. And then out of that came the Kasung and Kusung and so forth, yeah.
And as we move up through time, there is the empowerment of the Vajra Regent in 1976, mm-hmm. which seems like a genuine milestone in terms of choosing his successor mm-hmm. and also creating more of probably a system of check and balances. I can only think about it that way. In terms of the Kasung Kikyab and the Vajra Regent. Can you address what was it like to become the Kasung Kikyab around that time? And what it means?
He appointed me to that position. It's Kasung Kikyab means general command protector. And it was the overseer of the Kasung. And it, you know, so I was the head of the military, but I didn't really do that much in terms of what the military do, what the Kasung do. You know, I wasn't doing guard shifts. I was no longer driving him. And so in a sense, it was more like the Secretary of Defense role. It was kind of more like a civilian role overseeing and being the
policy advisor?
Policy and go-between. And it was more than policy. I mean, I was coordinating. I would lead the meetings of the leadership group, the command group.
What was it called at the time? Just command group? It wasn't the council of the Maki Rabjan or... just command group?
At that time, the command group, and later it became the Council of the Maki Rabjam.
Who was in the command group?
Well, initially, it was John Perks was the Kusung Dapun, and Jerry Haas was the Kasung Dapun, and then he was replaced in 77, I believe, while Rinpoche was on retreat, by Jim Kimian. And then there was a next level of officers, Rupans, and perhaps Kadu as well, who participated in the command group. And my sense of it at that time was not so much that it was about the regent or balancing of powers, although that, you know, may indeed have been an important part of Rinpoche's motivation, but my sense of it was more that he wanted to have a military, and at the same time he recognized the potential dangers in that, and he wanted me as his private secretary and somebody whom he trusted to keep an eye on them. So whereas the military officers, the Kasung officers, were, you know, pretty masculine, commanding, and sometimes aggressive.
Macho,
there you go, types. You know, I was not at all.
A poet.
I was a timid intellectual poet secretary. But it's also important to say that he did it as a way of working with me. It happened at the seminary, 1976 seminary in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, and I got quite depressed during that seminary. And I was teaching a course, and I missed one class, and I was trying to avoid Rinpoche as much as I could, but one particular occasion I wasn't able to avoid him. He called me over and he said, David, I'd like to ask your permission to undermine you. And, you know, I didn't know what he meant, but I also figured I didn't have that much to lose at that point. And I said, okay. And then nothing happened, but it was maybe 10 days later, without making any connection to that, and it was only much later that I realized that this is what he was referring to. He asked me to become the Kasung Kyukyap, to become the overseer of the Kasung. So the Kasung had already existed for a couple of years, and I was not part of it until that appointment or command. And that's also where the dynamic with the regent does come in, because that, I don't know if it was the same night or shortly thereafter, it was also the time at which he received the stroke of Ashe, and then the text, Golden Sun of the Great East, and the commentary and so forth. It was a very, very rich and intense time. And one night, he had an office in an unused wing of the hotel. It was a very large hotel. And so he had an office and a bedroom that he sometimes used. He also had an off-site place where he stayed. And he said, okay, now I want you to call the Vajra regent and tell him that if it became necessary for some reason in the future due to his misbehavior or corruption, or I forget exactly what the words were, but that was the import of it, that it would be my job to remove him from his position. And it was late at night. It was very cold because I think that wing wasn't heated. And there was only one telephone, a booth, and which was downstairs from where his office was, he took me down and he sat with me there in the booth while I called the regent. And I was very cold and somewhat scared, and hoping that the call wouldn't go through. But of course, it did. The regent picked up, and I told him what I was instructed to tell him. And he, I think he may have sensed that Rinpoche was right there, but he certainly knew it was coming from Rinpoche, and he said, okay, I hear you.